Good morning and welcome to today's edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan and these are the top stories of the day.
My ride or die. Woman flees California wildfires on a bike with her 70-pound dog in a duffel bag. By Arik Jenkins. A California woman fled the scene of wildfires in her neighborhood using a bike with her 70-pound dog tucked in a duffel bag by her side. College student Natasha Wallace was on her way home from studying late Monday night when she saw the series of fires closing in on her neighborhood in Santa Rosa, according to local Channel Fox 40. "Everything was gray, everything was destroyed, and it went for miles," Wallace told the station. But she didn't want to evacuate the area without her 4-year-old pit bull, Bentley. "I would never part ways with my dog, ever," Wallace told Fox. "That's my ride or die, oh my God, literally." So Wallace decided to put him in her car and leave the area, she said, but found herself trapped between other cars within minutes. "It was coming faster than I could leave in traffic, so I went back and got my bike," Wallace said. That made transporting Bentley difficult, though. So she grabbed a duffel bag she could sling around her body and instructed Bentley to get inside, she told Fox. "So I grabbed my dog and I told him, 'Hey man, this is serious. You need to just sit in the bag.' And he hopped right in," Wallace explained to the network. She said she managed to make it several miles down the road ahead of the fire before a man in a truck saw her and pulled over to give her and Bentley a ride. "I just wanted to say thank you to him, Paul Johnson," Wallace told Fox, adding that she's lucky to be alive, as her neighborhood was completely destroyed by the wildfire. "You don't even see a resemblance of what it used to be." At least 35 people have died as a result of the wildfires that have ravaged Northern California in recent weeks. Fair-faced, a legendary street photographer searches for the soul of America at state fairs. Photographs by Bruce Gilden. Text by Paul Moakley. Bruce Gilden has shadowed the residents of cities around the world, capturing the dark side of urban dwellers with a flash in hand. His often confrontational take on street photography is framed within his modern-day film noir sensibility. Since the start of his career in 1968, he says he has been compared to legendary street photographers like Ouija, William Klein, and Lisette Model. These are photographers who created a new space in a genre that has existed since photography's inception, pioneering styles that were entirely personal and captured an attitude about their time and perception of the world. 50 years later, Gilden has carved out a place for himself with almost 20 books in this category. Now he's redefining himself again. Taking an iconic line from war photographer Robert Capa to heart, "If the picture isn't good enough, you aren't close enough." Gilden has worked for years on getting closer to his own subjects. Some might even describe the work as aggressive. "The face is the environment," Gilden tells Time after returning from recent trips to the Iowa and Wisconsin state fairs where he made these portraits. "I wanted to do faces like this for 15 years, sort of like mug shots," Gilden says. "If you go back and look at compendiums from Paris or from L.A., you'll see all these criminal types. So that always fascinated me," he adds. "These guys had no pretense about being artists or anything. They were just doing their job. The Leica S camera enabled me to do this kind of picture." Gilden, like many photographers, often shies away from explaining the meaning in his photographs. "When people look at my pictures, I don't want to tell them what's in the pictures. I want them to look at the picture and make up their own story." But when it comes to style, Gilden is generous about sharing his process and technique. "I'm blunt," he says in his thick Brooklyn accent, "and I think that has a lot to do with the strength of my pictures. The older I get, the closer I get. I don't want to be sneaky. I'm up front and blunt. I'm self-assured and I treat people respectfully." The art happens within his interaction with subjects. "I think the picture is the result of the encounter between myself and the person who I'm photographing. There has to be some relation between us so we're on the same page." When photographing his latest series called Farm Boys and Farm Girls, he says, "They're very much in touch with life and death in a way that's natural." On his most recent trip to the Iowa State Fair, he captured a portrait of a 12-year-old boy with enormous tears welling up on his face. The kid was crying when his cow had to be taken out of the contest, he recalls. So I went to the mother and we had a nice conversation, and she said it was okay if I take a picture of her son. I felt bad for the kid because I know what it is to work for years and then a whole moment, something falls apart that's out of your control. So I empathize with the kid, but at the end of the day, I'm a photographer. Through his lens, the pain of that moment becomes monumental, heightened in both color and lighting. When asked about documenting that kind of pain, Gildon reflects on his own childhood in Brooklyn. That event, that moment, should be a catalyst to a springboard that makes you stronger, he says. I had a very tough childhood emotionally, and I knew things that children shouldn't know, and I kept it inside of me my entire life, he adds. My past was totally negative, but I used it as positive, and it gave me that strength in my photos, and I've never changed. When reflecting on what he hopes this work will add up to, he laughs a little. It's America. I'm an American photographer, and the farm boys and farm girls are very middle America, and that's a part of America I don't know well, he says. I enjoy learning about people, seeing where they live, talking to them. I would like to get the soul out of somebody. That's my main interest. I want the viewer to feel that person. Bruce Gildon is a photographer based in New York City, represented by Magnum Photos. Paul Moakley is the deputy director of photography at Time, and you can follow him on Twitter at Paul Moakley.
The Women's March invited Bernie Sanders. Then the trouble started. By Charlotte Alter. When the Women's Convention announced that Bernie Sanders would speak on the opening night of its national conference in Detroit later this month, the response on social media was swift and brutal. Many supporters of the group, which spearheaded the record-setting marches around the U.S. to protest President Donald Trump's inauguration in January, were outraged that conference organizers would pick a white man to address a convention meant to elevate women of color. Others were annoyed that Sanders, who recently endorsed a candidate for mayor in Nebraska who has been criticized as anti-abortion, would be embraced by a movement that supports reproductive rights. Others nursed a grudge against Sanders and his supporters for their role in Hillary Clinton's election defeat. On the surface, the hoopla may seem silly. Many of the critics were objecting to the misperception that the Vermont senator was headlining a women's conference. He isn't. The Women's Convention doesn't technically have a headliner, but its featured speaker is Representative Maxine Waters, a California Democrat who has called for Trump's impeachment. Sanders is one of only two men among the 42 speakers at the three-day conference, held in Detroit from October 27th to October 29th. The publicity around the former presidential candidate's appearance was a function of the fact that he is the most famous speaker on the docket. But the controversy over Sanders' role in the Women's Convention raises larger questions about whether the progressive grassroots uprising against Trump's agenda can thrive as a leaderless movement that aspires to unite coalitions across the left. How can the movement amplify the voices of specific groups, especially women, immigrants, and people of color, while embracing white men as full participants? How can it harness the activist outrage that drove the largest demonstration in U.S. history while expanding its ranks to win seats in the midterm elections? The best way for the so-called resistance to achieve tangible change is to build a broad coalition. But is it still a women's movement if it showcases male leaders? In their first interview since the controversy erupted Thursday, the leaders of the convention defended the move, chalked up the controversy to a misunderstanding, and expressed dismay that Waters' role at the gathering was overlooked. Why did the same people not take as much interest in sharing and helping to uplift Maxine Waters and the other women of color? Asked Tamika Mallory, a racial justice organizer and co-founder of the Women's March. People who claim to be feminists often ignore the voices of women of color, and particularly black women. Mallory acknowledged that inviting Sanders was a controversial choice. Some people just don't want to hear from Bernie Sanders, says Mallory. There are some people who don't believe that a man has a place at a woman's convention. Bob Bland, an entrepreneur and Women's March co-founder, said she was surprised by the controversy about Sanders' role at the convention, which will include panels on mobilization for the midterms and activist training. "Do we want to relitigate the past or move forward together?" asked Bland. "Even though we don't agree on every issue, we have to work together to win the midterms in 2018. Otherwise, we will continue to lose. We need to focus on that." Others disagreed. "This choice sends the wrong message," tweeted Stephanie Schrock, president of Emily's List, a political organization that funds and supports pro-choice women candidates, who is also scheduled to speak at the event. "We have more women leaders in elected office than ever before. Women are leading in the Senate. This is a moment to highlight them." A Change.org petition asking the Women's Convention organizers to reconsider Sanders' role had gotten nearly 8,000 signatures by Friday afternoon. The organizers also invited leading female Democrats like Clinton, Senator Kamala Harris, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, and Senator Elizabeth Warren to speak at the convention. But organizers say the event did not work with their schedules. The dispute boils down to a question of strategy. If the goal among the organizers is to try and generate the broadest possible support for their agenda, then it could potentially be the right call to invite Sanders, says Jennifer Lawless, director of the Women in Politics Institute at American University, who points out that Sanders has made feminist enemies when he advocated for endorsing candidates who oppose abortion rights. "If your goal is feminist ideological purity, it raises a lot of questions and suggests they might be selling out." The misunderstanding may have been rooted in the group's aversion to hierarchy. The women's convention is called Reclaiming Our Time, after Waters' now famous retort that she was reclaiming my time in a congressional hearing. Waters is giving a major speech at the event on Saturday, but she is not given top billing on the agenda because organizers have so far avoided designating any keynote speakers or official headliners. Instead, the speakers are listed in alphabetical order, and there is nothing on the website that indicates that any speeches are more important than others. "I was surprised that a lot of women that marched on January 21st were so up in arms over this," adds Bland. "I wish that many had mobilized with us when we were marching to confront white supremacy in August. But that doesn't mean the controversy is going away. It highlights some of the deep issues that came out as a result of the campaign," says Debbie Walsh, director of the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers University. "It feels a bit like the marginalizing of women at an event that is supposed to be put on by women, for women, about women." Former Army Secretary Donald Trump's transgender troops ban weakens the military, by Eric K. Fanning. Fanning served as a 22nd Secretary in the Army. "As the 22nd Secretary of the Army, my job was to ensure the Army remained the most effective fighting force the world has ever known. Critical to this effort was the constant recruiting, training, and retention of the best people our country had to offer. The strength of the U.S. Army derives not from its technologically advanced weapon systems, but from the intelligence, creativity, and ingenuity of the more than 1 million soldiers currently serving here at home and in 150 countries around the world. I prioritize guaranteeing that every American who could meet the Army's high standards had the opportunity to serve. This included changing policies that once prevented women from being assigned to certain combat units and breaking down barriers that forced religious Americans to choose between serving their country or being true to their faith. It also meant acknowledging the existence of transgender service members in the ranks and establishing a framework for their open service. I know firsthand the need for our military to attract the best talent, regardless of their race, national origin, gender identity, or sexual orientation. That's why I've submitted declarations in the legal challenges to President Donald Trump's harmful decision to ban transgender individuals from serving in the military, including Doe v. Trump, the first case filed against the president's directive. Our all-volunteer military cannot long succeed let alone thrive, when it turns away qualified, capable, and patriotic individuals committed to serving their country. Barring qualified transgender Americans from serving is a mistake. Military policy is set by thoughtful and well-reasoned process and review. That is precisely what had been done before the president's shocking course reversal, with no justified military-related reason for doing so. From 2015 until 2016, the Pentagon conducted a comprehensive evaluation of how the total force would be impacted by allowing transgender people to serve openly. I oversaw the Army's participation in that process, reviewed the reports and data provided by military and medical experts, and evaluated all relevant evidence regarding how this would affect military readiness, cost, and recruiting. Based on our findings, we were able to report to Secretary of Defense Ash Carter that permitting transgender people to serve openly in the U.S. military would not pose any significant cost or risk to readiness, unit cohesion, morale, or good order and discipline, a conclusion independently shared by my counterparts in the Navy and Air Force. As a result, and relying on the Secretary's June 2016 policy change, transgender service members stationed across the world have come out to their colleagues in chain of command. Soon after the policy change, I visited the Army's Drill Sergeant School, where all active and reserve component drill instructors receive training. There I met instructor Sergeant Ken Ochoa, who told me he was transgender. Sergeant Ochoa relayed his positive experience in the Army. Although this meeting happened prior to the policy update, his command had been supportive of his transition, already having taken steps to ensure he was able to present authentically and therefore bring all of his talents to his job. Today, Sergeant Ochoa and soldiers like him fear that, despite the Pentagon telling them that they no longer need to lie about who they are in order to serve, their honesty will be used against them to unfairly end their military careers, despite their demonstrated records of service. Transgender Americans have long served in all branches of the military, and they have done so with honor and valor. Their presence in the force is not a disruption, and providing them with the same medical care we provide every other service member is not a significant budget expense. What is disruptive is ripping transgender Americans out of ready units, wasting the tens of millions of dollars taxpayers have spent on their training, and asking military leaders to focus on executing this purge rather than the challenges posed by North Korea, Russia, and terrorism. Politicizing the military by excluding entire groups of Americans who are qualified to serve makes no sense. Despite the Trump administration's recent claim that transgender individuals have not yet suffered harm from the policy, every day this ban is in place, it hurts our service members, causes confusion for commanders, and diminishes our force. Rolling back the clock on allowing all those who are qualified to serve undermines the principle that America is strongest when all of its citizens can see themselves in the military sworn to defend their freedom. I am proud to support the legal efforts of those transgender soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines challenging the constitutionality of President Trump's actions and calling for an immediate end to this ban.
Harvey Weinstein expelled from Academy amid sexual assault allegations. Disgraced movie mogul Harvey Weinstein's membership in the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences has been revoked by its board. The decision was reached Saturday in an emergency session. It comes after recent reports by the New York Times and the New Yorker that revealed sexual harassment and rape allegations against Weinstein going back decades. The move by the Academy is virtually unprecedented. The Academy is the world's top movie organization and is home to the Oscars. In a brief statement, the Academy said it sends a message that sexually predatory behavior in the film industry is over. Weinstein was ousted a week ago from the Weinstein Company, the movie and TV production company he co-founded, and which is now struggling to survive this scandal. He has denied the accusations.
President Trump had a busy week. Catch up with what mattered in 5 minutes. By Maya Roden.
It's been a busy week in Washington, D.C., with President Trump taking action on everything from health care to Iran. The House of Representatives passed $36.5 billion in aid for Puerto Rico and parts of California hit by wildfires, reauthorized the Federal Aviation Administration, and gave tax relief to victims of Hurricanes Harvey, Irma, and Maria. But the real action was at the White House, where Trump took several actions to undo the legacy of his predecessor, President Obama. Here's a quick look at what happened and how much it matters. The Iran nuclear deal. What happened? On Friday, President Trump will announce that he is not certifying that Iran is in compliance with the nuclear deal that President Obama negotiated. What does that mean? Though Trump promised to rip up the deal as a candidate, this isn't exactly that. The president is saying Iran is not upholding the spirit of the deal, but his administration is not walking away from it. What's the bottom line? While Trump wanted to scrap the deal, key officials, including the Defense Secretary and the Secretary of State, reportedly warned against doing that. So Trump is passing the buck to Congress, which must now decide whether or not sanctions will be reimposed. Congress is deeply divided on the issue and could choose not to act. The Affordable Care Act. What happened? Two things, really. First, Trump signed an executive order that could allow people to access cheaper insurance, though those plans will likely cover less. Later on Thursday, the Trump administration announced it would not continue funding subsidies to the insurance market. Those subsidies help keep insurance costs low for poorer Americans. Trump tweeted, "Obamacare is a broken mess. Piece by piece, we will now begin the process of giving America the great health care it deserves." What does that mean? Politically, the president is viewing these moves as a win on his goal of repealing the Affordable Care Act. On Friday, he called them major steps towards scrapping the ACA, which the Republican Congress has repeatedly failed to repeal in an address to conservative voters. But they could mean millions of people will not be able to afford their insurance this year. What's the bottom line? The executive order's changes could take a while to affect people and the insurance marketplace. The elimination of cost-sharing reduction payments will not. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that the cost of silver-level plans would increase by an average of 20% in 2018 and 25% by 2020. According to the CBO, 5% of the population could have no access to marketplace insurance that same year. The change could also increase the federal deficit by an estimated $194 billion over 10 years. Trump tweeted, "The Democrats' Obamacare is imploding. Massive subsidy payments to their pet insurance companies has stopped. Dems should call me to fix." Puerto Rico. What happened? The situation in Puerto Rico remains dire. Only an estimated 10 to 16% of the island has power some 3 weeks after the hurricane. But on Thursday, the president appeared to suggest federal workers could be pulled away from the U.S. territory in tweeting that they couldn't stay forever. The House of Representatives approved $36.5 billion in aid funding for the territory and other areas of the U.S. impacted by natural disasters. Trump tweeted, "We cannot keep FEMA, the military, and the first responders who have been amazing under the most difficult circumstances in PR forever." What does it mean? The president's tweets sparked a fierce backlash from Democrats on Capitol Hill and the mayor of San Juan, who has been highly critical of the federal government's response to the disaster. Mayor Carmen Yulín Cruz told CNN that the president was acting like a hater-in-chief rather than a commander-in-chief. "This isn't personal," she said. "This isn't politics. This is about saving lives." Bottom line, lives are at risk in Puerto Rico. Saving people and helping the island rebuild should be the focus. By Friday, the president appeared to backtrack, tweeting that he will always be with the people there. The wonderful people of Puerto Rico, with their unmatched spirit, know how bad things were before the H's. "I will always be with them," Trump tweeted. Dreamers. What happened? The White House released an outline of all the hardline immigration policies the administration wants passed in exchange for any deal to protect undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. as children. The list included a border wall, stricter requirements for those seeking asylum, more law enforcement, and a mandatory immigration check for workers known as E-Verify. What does it mean? The demands pose a direct threat to ongoing negotiations over a replacement for the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, which the president began phasing out at the direction of his attorney general in September. Trump gave Congress a March deadline for a fix. After that point, there will be no protections against deportation for immigrants enrolled in the program. What's the bottom line? The president appears willing to offer Congress and the immigrants a bit of leeway. Republican Senator James Lankford of Oklahoma, who has introduced a bill to protect the young undocumented immigrants, said that the president told him he was willing to give the Congress more time. The president's comment to me was that we put a 6-month deadline out there. Let's work it out. If we can't get it worked out in 6 months, we'll give it some more time, but we've got to get this worked out legislatively, Lankford told constituents at a town hall, according to the Washington Post. Q&A. Masha Gessen sees a bleak future for Putin's Russia, by Simon Schuster. Following her 2012 biography of Russian President Vladimir Putin, the author and journalist Masha Gessen turns her focus to the social traumas and disappointed hopes of her native country, as seen through the perspectives of the 7 characters in her latest nonfiction book, The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia, which was published on October 3rd. 3 of the book's characters, a psychoanalyst, a sociologist, and a nationalist philosopher, possess what Gessen calls the tools of knowing that are required to analyze Russia's transition from Soviet communism to Putin's brand of state capitalism. The other 4 are young people, born during the final years of the Soviet Empire, who feel the lingering effects of its dissolution on their own skin. One through the murder of her father, another through her struggle with Russia's system of political repression. Gessen spoke to Time on September 26th about the roots and faults of the system Putin built and its similarities to President Donald Trump's America. Below is a transcript of the conversation, shortened and edited for clarity. Time. One of the Russian phrases at the center of your book is Budushevo net, there is no future. What does that mean to you and to the characters in the book? Gessen. I started out trying to tell a story of Russia's trauma, and one of the hallmarks of trauma is the loss of the ability to plan for the future. It's really about the loss of control. This sense of having no control over your own life is very important to creating a totalitarian subject. People express that with the phrase Budushevo net. The word totalitarian is usually reserved for the most repressive regimes, like North Korea or Hitler's Germany. Why do you believe Russia has reached that level of state control? I'm not using that word in relation to Putin. The regime that exists in Russia is not a totalitarian regime. Putin has created the regime of a mafia state. But because he created this regime on the ruins of a totalitarian society, totalitarian habits have kicked in. It's a bizarre situation where the regime sends out signals that aren't about establishing totalitarian control. The regime just wants to plunder and stay in power. But society, which has been conditioned by so many years of totalitarianism, responds by creating totalitarian mechanisms, like when people start raiding bookstores in their own neighborhoods to make sure there is de facto censorship. So Russian totalitarianism comes from the grassroots, not from the top down? What we have is neither of those things. The Kremlin just sends out signals that are actually not that different from Trump's dog whistling to his supporters, to the people who share his idea of this imaginary past. Trump did this after the violence in Charlottesville and after the athletes began kneeling during the national anthem. He sends out these signals to his supporters. And in America, the response comes from both sides of the debate, often with people showing solidarity with each other, like the athletes taking a knee. But Russian society responds to such signals in a very different way. In Russia, the dog whistle does not elicit cries of protest. Because of its history with totalitarianism, Russian society responds with mobilization. What are they mobilizing towards? Scholars of totalitarianism talk about the importance of this constant movement, this forever war, this need to do battle on behalf of something that needs protection. In Russia, this something has been postulated as faith and traditional values. At least one of the characters in your book also mobilized against Putin during the protests in 2011 and 2012. How important is this form of political awakening in Russia today? I'm pessimistic about such political awakenings. For most people, these awakenings are very short-lived. As the protests died down in 2012, there was no contradiction for them in returning to their regular lives and finding nothing about the regime objectionable. What about this year's wave of anti-Putin protests? They were widely attended by Russian teenagers who were born and raised during Putin's 18 years in power. Yes, and there was an incredible intellectual and emotional focus on the teenagers who were protesting. But that's indicative to me of a really sad tendency. After the Soviet Union collapsed, people thought the last Soviet generation was going to be the great hope for democracy. When that failed, their hopes shifted to the first post-Soviet generation, and then the second one. And now the people who were the young vanguard of the protests just 5 years ago, they've already written themselves off, and they are looking to teenagers to save the country. And what if they don't? But Russian teenagers did not experience the traumas of the Soviet collapse, so aren't they more immune to these traumas, these totalitarian tendencies you describe? That's a philosophical question. There's the hypothesis that things just keep happening to Russians, things that keep turning them into the same kind of subjects as opposed to citizens. The more credible hypothesis, I think, is that there is a kind of trauma, a social trauma that is passed on from generation to generation, and that doesn't go away just because we all decided that the Soviet regime is no more. After the U.S. elections, Putin has often been depicted in the West as some all-power figure. Do you think the West overestimates him? It depends. I think his power in influencing the U.S. elections is overestimated because there is an overwhelming desire to lay blame for Trump somewhere outside the United States. But otherwise, I don't think it's overestimated. He does wield unilateral power in his country. Is there a system of checks and balances that would limit his power? There isn't. But does he have the kind of absolute control usually associated with totalitarian regimes? Do people today in Russia live as people in the Soviet Union lived under Stalin? Of course not. But does Putin have the same political staying power as Stalin did? Does he have the near guarantee of maintaining power and being able to do whatever he wants for the rest of his life? Yes. Will his authoritarian system survive after he's gone? When Stalin died, the Eisenhower administration was terrified about what would happen. They feared that the hardliners would come to power, which is incredible to think about. What was their concept of a hardliner if the baseline was Joseph Stalin? This suggests that the devil you know has incredible symbolic power in politics. The idea that hardliners might come to power if Putin disappears is very useful to him. It's something that every dictator cultivates, this idea that there's someone even scarier. So what future do you see for Russia after Putin? I don't have a lot of hope for Russia when Putin goes, because I think that the kind of damage that has been done to the country hasn't been understood. We've never seen a country that has been this battered, and I don't know whether there's any way for it to recover. When Putin goes, I think Russia is not going to stay within its current borders. There's going to be some kind of redrawing of the Federation. And if there is any hope, then it's for the countries that are formed in the wake of the Russian Federation that managed to narratively divorce themselves from Russian history. You're saying the country will break apart. Doesn't that play into Putin's propaganda that without him there is no Russia? Russia continues to be an empire in a world that has pretty effectively dispensed with empires. So why is the Russian Federation of more than 80 constituent parts, most of which have distinct national identities, some of which have distinct languages and cultures, and all of which now, as a result of being plundered by the Putin regime, have nationalist movements, why should they stay together? So Putin's personal hold on power is all that's holding Russia together? Since Putin does not think he is going to die, there is not going to be any succession plan in place when he dies, and there is going to be a period of disarray and uncertainty, and that will be a perfect opening for the final breakup of the empire. That sounds like a terrifying prospect. I hope we live long enough to see it. What to Know About the Real Case That Inspired the Movie Marshall by Lily Rothman. The legal career of Thurgood Marshall, the man who became famous arguing cases such as Brown v. Board of Education and in 1967 became the first black Supreme Court justice, is full of cases that changed the American legal landscape. But the case that inspired the new movie Marshall, arriving in theaters on Friday and starring Chadwick Boseman, isn't one of those famous lawsuits. It's not a grand civil rights case that would go all the way to the Supreme Court, nor has the name of the man Marshall defended gone down in history. And yet, it provides a window into a side of civil rights history that's often overshadowed, but no less important. The facts of the case, as described in Ron James Jr.'s book Root and Branch, Charles Hamilton Houston, Thurgood Marshall, and the Struggle to End Segregation, were that a wealthy white Connecticut woman named Eleanor Strubing had accused her black chauffeur, Joseph Spell, of raping her while her husband was out of town for work. She claimed that over the course of one December 1940 night, he had raped her four times, written a ransom note, bound and gagged her, and then thrown her into a reservoir. Spell maintained that while it was true that he had initiated a sexual interaction, it had been consensual, and that they had stopped when she said she was worried about being found out. Marshall and local attorney Samuel Friedman, played in the movie by Josh Gad, suggested that Strubing had lied about the rape in order to deal with her own guilt and fear about what she'd done, and convinced the jury that her story was inconsistent with her own prior statements and the physical evidence. Spell was found not guilty. The celebrated lawyer saw criminal cases like Joseph Spell's as something of a break from the segregation cases that tended to occupy his time. They also were helpful for the NAACP as an organization, as lurid news coverage helped drum up membership. As Mark V. Tushnet explains in his book, Making Civil Rights Law, headline-making criminal cases were one of the most effective branch recruitment tools at their disposal in the pre-war 1940s, especially because of the organization's widely publicized stance on only taking such cases when they believed the defendant was innocent. At this point in his career, Marshall was better known to the public for his defense of criminals than for his attacks on Jim Crow, Juan Williams writes in his biography of Marshall. He stood as a living, breathing shield for black people against the lynch mob, as well as the judge's death sentence. And though segregation was not the law of the land in states like Connecticut, and Marshall was less likely to face the threat of physical violence in the course of doing his job there, the Spell case is a reminder that such a shield was necessary in the North, too. Thanks to barriers on employment, education, and residency, African Americans were left with few options beyond domestic work of the type Spell performed. Proving his innocence was also a matter of economic life and death, as reports spread of fearful white families dismissing their black employees. That aspect of the case was explored by Daniel J. Sharfstein, a professor of law and history at Vanderbilt, in a 2005 Legal Affairs article, pointing out that none other than W.E.B. Du Bois himself, a founder of the NAACP, resigned from the organization in a huff in 1934 over the need to pay more attention to Northern discrimination as a barrier to full racial equality. There were any number of cases the NAACP could have taken, but they only had so many lawyers and the resources were limited, so they had to be very careful about the cases they picked. They chose to put resources into Joseph Spell's defense, not just because it was making lurid headlines, but because of what the fact that it was making lurid headlines represented, Sharfstein tells Time. It seemed like this was a case that was actually harming people's livelihoods, and as a result, was a case that was drawing a tremendous amount of attention in the local African American communities. Sending Thurgood Marshall, who was already a well-known figure, sent the message that this case mattered to the NAACP. People would listen, locally and nationally. And in retrospect, what they would have heard was an additional unfortunate lesson about the history of civil rights. Work that Marshall did in places like Connecticut for people like Joseph Spell was a reminder that changing the law does not necessarily change people's prejudices. Ending codified segregation would not mean the end of NAACP's legal work. At a basic level, I view the Spell case as a premonition of the kinds of challenges that the NAACP would face in the absence of de jure segregation, Sharfstein says. Once Brown v. Board is decided, this huge NAACP victory, then the real battles begin. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.